A Struggle to Read, the latest on diagnosis and treatment of dyslexia. It's not easy to recognize in young school children, but steps are being taken to screen kids who appear to have difficulty learning to read and spell. By some accounts, dyslexia affects 1 in 5 people, and many adults may not discover they have this learning disability until later in life. Some may have developed coping skills that help them work around their challenges. Those who do struggle and don't get help can drop out of school and develop low self-esteem. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll learn more about the signs of dyslexia and about how school systems and professionals are helping students adapt to their disability. We'll find out what Maine is doing to screen for dyslexia and about the accommodations available for affected kids. The latest on dyslexia, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. When a child is just starting school, it can be difficult to spot signs of dyslexia. A learning disorder that makes it difficult to read, dyslexia is hard to diagnose, and many people simply grow up compensating for it. Today we'll learn more about dyslexia and how to help those who have it. Joining me in the studio, Barbara Melnick. She's head of school at Owkosisko School. Amanda Morin is a parent advocate, former teacher, and author. She's with misunderstood.org. Understood.org. My mistake. And Sandy Cord is an original member of the group Learning Disabilities of Maine and has grown children who have learning disabilities. As always, we want to hear from you as well. Do you know someone who struggles with reading? Are you wondering what an older child or adult with signs of dyslexia can do? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
I guess we probably have this workaday sense of dyslexia as this reading disability in which, you know, letters are appear out of order. But if you could give us a sort of more robust definition, Barbara, we'll start with you. What is dyslexia?
Sure. So dyslexia is a neurologically based difference in the way the brain is wired. People often think of people as being pre-wired to learn to read as they are pre-wired for language, but we know that's not the case. So there are a number of places in the brain where there can be a glitch in how sound is processed and or how letter symbols are processed. We have to remember that the goal of reading is comprehension, but the dyslexia piece comes in mostly at the level of learning to decode and encode words. So take the words off the page, break them down so they understand, they get the word correct and know what it means, and then the other end, which is encoding, which is spelling. And there can be a number of places in that process. So there are subtypes of dyslexia also.
And we'll get to that. As you mentioned, we are wired to talk. It's part of our natural wiring, as we said.
Correct.
But because written language and this coding came along relatively late in the evolution of humans, reading is something that we do have to learn. I think that's the point you were making. And dyslexia affects that learning capacity there.
Correct.
This is Amanda, and I think I would jump in and say that dyslexia can also, it's known as a language-based learning disability. So it can affect sometimes that ability to speak, to write, because it's the language component of the brain that is different. It's wired a little bit differently. So sometimes we're not just talking about kids who have difficulty reading. There's also other language components to it as well. And I think the biggest misconception about dyslexia is that it is just seeing words backwards or seeing letters backwards or things moving around.
Can it affect math skills?
Yes, actually, it's really interesting to me that you asked that, because most commonly co-occurring with dyslexia is a math disorder known as dyscalculia. And so it can affect that, especially when you're talking about kids who are looking at word problems, because you're trying to decode that information in multiple ways.
And what is dysgraphia, and how does that relate to this disorder?
I guess I'll answer that again, unless Barbara, you want to jump in this, Amanda, again. Dysgraphia is a disorder of written expression, which is a fancy way of saying sometimes kids have trouble not only with handwriting, but also getting their ideas down on paper and organizing their ideas. And that's what dysgraphia is.
Mm-hmm. And this is to anyone, and feel free to jump in. But what causes it? Is there a sense of what's going on here in the brain?
Yeah.
Barbara?
Well, we're starting to know more and more, and the science, the neuroscience, is really quite fascinating, and it's changing all the time. But we do have very clear indications right now of the areas of the brain that are affected and the difficulties with particularly fluency. So when a fluent reader is reading, you see a number of areas of the brain light up, but it's almost simultaneous. I mean, they can measure the differences, but it's in like milliseconds. When a dyslexic reader is reading, you're seeing more time spent in different areas that makes it much harder to read fluently. And that's always the goal. The goal is fluency, which is a combination of speed and accuracy. We want to have both of those things. And that is interfered with by these various areas of the brain that are either taking in the sounds or, as Amanda mentioned, attaching meaning to them. So a lot of the language areas, but it's also a visual skill, right? So it actually, the occipital lobes in the back of your brain have a lot to do with that ability to quickly recognize words and go right to meaning without having to spend a lot of time sounding them out or trying to figure out what they are.
And if you're a parent, you'll often see, if you've had a child evaluated, you'll see that noted as rapid automated mm-hmm. naming. Mm-hmm. It's an RAN. It's a rapid automatized naming test, which is that putting things names to objects and yeah. things like that.
Sandy, you have children with learning disabilities. Tell us about how you discovered those and how that might help inform other parents who are listening.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have an adult son with, actually he's gifted and dyslexic. And early on we noticed in primary school he was struggling with reading. He was creative and would invent this story to go with the pictures, but he really wasn't doing a lot of decoding and sounding out the letters or recognizing new letters when they're presented to him. So we quickly approached school and said, we want an evaluation to see what's going on. You know, bright kid, but, you know, there's difficulty here with, you know, reading, and he would avoid reading.
Mm-hmm. Was the school equipped to meet your request and do the screening and identify the problem?
They were. They did evaluate him and began some programming. We did eventually get an independent evaluation with more suggestions on specific programming. Barbara and Amanda, I know, can speak to this, but dyslexic students need a very specific type of instruction in reading. Many students will catch the reading process pretty automatically when presented with a multitude. But for kids with dyslexia, they need very specific instruction. And I'll let Amanda or Barbara.
Yeah, well, Barbara, I was going to ask you at what age are you specifically looking to make sure that there's an age that can you be too young, you know, like kindergarten too young, or what's the core age?
There are very clear signs that reading is going to be difficult, even in preschool. And with some of the brain testing they can do, not that most of us are going to have our kids, you know, in a neuroscience lab, but they actually can see signs as early as a year in laboratory settings. But certainly preschool and kindergarten, there are some very clear signs of which students are going to have difficulty. And they are not the typical reversing letters. At that age, that's a very common thing that all kids are doing. It's more likely to involve what we call phonological and phonemic awareness, which has to do with the sounds that letters make and being able to break them up. So rhyming is a very early indicator trouble with rhyme.
Yeah, and that ability to manipulate words. So when we say the word cup, and you can say, what's at the beginning of cup? And we hear k, it's a C. And then if you say, make cup into pup, kids will have trouble manipulating that beginning sound very young. Mm-hmm. They may have trouble recognizing the sounds that match the letters. And that's also developmentally appropriate for some young children. But if it's persistent, that's a warning symptom sign.
Yeah, is there a sense that most schools are equipped to identify this, to do screening, or is that an issue?
Here in Maine, there's a law now, which I know Barbara and Sandy can both speak to, that says that schools need to be screening from kindergarten to grade 2, which is fantastic. So early intervention makes a huge difference, and that screening is helpful.
But that's screening for every child or for children who are identified as having a potential problem?
Every child.
And for training for teachers, though, is that something that is being worked on in terms of getting more training for teachers to deal with the accommodations needed for dyslexic children?
I think there's definitely a need for it, and I think that people are trying very hard to make sure teachers are equipped for that. Where there is a dyslexia specialist here in Maine attached with that law, and I'm going to ask Sandy or Barbara if they remember who that is, because I can't remember at the moment.
Lisa Wittes is her name. She is Maine's dyslexia consultant. I was in touch with her, but unfortunately she had another appointment today.
Yeah.
And Maine's law does, in fact, have a bit of a flaw in that it doesn't say universal screening, which is what we prefer. Maine's law says that any child in K through 2 who is having difficulty learning to read, and I think it's important to realize that this, like everything else, is a continuum. You can be very mildly dyslexic. You can be severely dyslexic. You can be gifted and dyslexic. So they also runs the gamut of intellectual abilities. And so it can be complicated to see those things. And for some of the brighter kids, they are so good at compensating that they often don't get picked up.
And they might also have another disability in tandem with that, attention deficit.
Yes.
And the symptoms of those too, because I often see them compared in preparing for this show, dyslexia and ADHD, do they share sort of common symptoms or signs?
I think they can look similar, right? And I think that's where it's a good evaluation is really helpful in separating out what you're looking at. The signs of ADHD, the attention deficit disorder, can be inattention. You can have hyperactivity and impulsivity, distractibility. All of those things which you may also see in a student who is having trouble reading, but the reasons behind it are different. And a lot of times what you're seeing is avoidance behavior with kids who are having trouble reading.
And the consequences of this on the child aren't just academic, being falling behind. There are self-esteem issues, fear of reading, and all kinds of things. Right, Sandy?
Yes, very much so. You'll see. And I think one of the critical points is in terms of getting an early identification, that child now feels like, you know, they're not stupid. They learn differently, but they can learn. And it's important for that self-esteem to understand and for them to understand. And then once they understand their dyslexia or other learning disabilities, as they gradually get older, they can become self-advocates. And that is critically important as they reach middle school, high school, and go to post-secondary.
I love to hear you talk about that. That's great. That's great to hear somebody talk about teaching your child what's going on with them so they don't feel stigmatized. It's great.
As we said, I think, at the top, that as many as 1 in 5 people are affected by dyslexia. But is it, Barbara, it's the conventional understanding or the accepted belief that this disorder is underdiagnosed?
Absolutely.
And why?
Well, again, a lot of people are compensating really hard, and they may just be working for hours on things that would take most people much less time. I believe, to some extent, the brighter you are, the more you compensate. We often diagnose adults, and it often happens when their children are diagnosed, or even grandparents. Once they see that evaluation and what it means, all of a sudden they go, oh my goodness, that's why I had so much trouble in school. And those people tend to be, you know, and again, everyone says, you're so smart, you're so smart. And in their head, they're saying, so why is this so hard? why is the kid next to me getting it in 10 minutes and it's taking me an hour?
But can an adult in that case, who is, as you say, smart and knows about dyslexia, why can they not have a sense of their own disability? That is, recognize, oh, the letters seem reversed to me, or I can't make sense of what I'm reading. You know, I'm just curious about why they can't see that of themselves.
Sometimes it's an inside baseball thing to some degree, right? Because, see, we're all sitting here and this is what we know. And we know the signs and symptoms of dyslexia. Sometimes adults have grown up and they just know it's hard for them. And they don't know why. And they may not have a sense that it's not typical, that kind of difficulty.
Right.
And so, and Barbara, it's, this is hereditary, but not everyone who has a child, not every person with dyslexia who has a child will be dyslexic. And but describe, if you could, the relation, or I guess the numbers around how, you
know. How hereditary?
Yeah, how hereditary it is.
I'm not sure I have a good numeric answer for that one. Yeah. So Amanda's telling me about 25%
Amanda,
is.
I didn't want to interrupt.
That's
but
okay.
Typically, it's the way that we have seen this in research is that if a child has dyslexia, they have a likelihood of having 1 in 4 close relative who also has dyslexia. So a grandparent, a parent. So it's sort of about a 25%. I wouldn't quote me on that because I'm not a researcher, but that's about where we're seeing that right now.
And again, it's a matter of degree. You might, as you were saying, you might be severely dyslexic, but does the spectrum run up to a point where it's really borderline?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And for the for those people, does assistance help, or do they can they simply get through undiscovered?
Both.
Yeah.
I work with a fair amount of nursing and medical students, and many of them have gotten through, you know, up to medical school without being diagnosed, and they did it by just working harder. So it can. But there are two things. I mean, yes, absolutely teaching even with adults is helpful and helping them understand why it's difficult for them. But also, we live in a pretty good time for this because the technology is really quite superb. So it's easy to get books that you can listen to and read along with. They're all, you know, can be downloaded on all of our devices these days. There are lots of applications and software that go over and above that. You can click on something, get a dictionary definition. You can get a picture. You can have it read back to you. You can talk into the computer instead of having to write. So that those are, like, in my mind, I separate out compensatory tools like the technology and direct instruction. And really, you should be doing both because dyslexia doesn't go away.
Yeah.
And even people who had excellent instruction and excellent outcomes are still going to tire more easily when they read and probably, although not always, read somewhat slower.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems. NorrisInc.com.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, an interview with Sally Yates. As acting attorney general, she said no to the so-called Muslim travel ban.
And then what happened?
I was fired.
You were fired by Donald Trump before it was fashionable to be fired by Donald Trump.
Sally Yates talks with Jeffrey Toobin next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, then Sunday night at 11, here on Maine Public Radio. Are you interested in traveling to Sicily? Maine Public Travel is headed to Sicily next May on another of our cultural explorations to this fascinating island. You're invited to join Morning Edition host Irwin Gratz and other friends of Maine Public. Our Many Flavors of Sicily 10-day tour will involve sightseeing, tours, lectures, and music that will offer insight and understanding of Sicily and its people. Learn more about Maine Public's Sicily tour by visiting our website, mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Understanding Dyslexia. Joining me in the studio, Amanda Morin. She's a former teacher and parent advocate with Understood.org. Sandy Court is with Learning Disabilities of Maine and has grown children with learning disabilities. And Barbara Melnick is head of Occosisco School. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Janet Tebow, president of the Massachusetts branch of the International Dyslexia Association. Janet, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So as we've said, dyslexia affects up to 20% of people in the United States. Is it also a worldwide problem, no matter in what language someone is reading?
Yes, you're correct.
And is it about the same percentage worldwide?
It is, although English is an especially challenging language. We have a lot of quirky words that don't follow rules. So while students may be able to master a more rule-based language, they still have the fundamental neurobiological challenge of being born with what we're calling dyslexia.
Interesting. So what's your sense of how efforts are going here in Maine compared to elsewhere in the country or globally in terms of screening and addressing dyslexia?
I think nationwide there's a growing awareness of the need to identify students early, and that the typical wait to fail model, where we don't start looking or picking up kids who are struggling to read until third or fourth grade, isn't the most effective model. So I think a lot of states are realizing that it's better for the student and the family, but it's also a more cost-effective solution. If you can start to identify students earlier, you're able to get them on track before reading starts to really become a major thrust of learning. So by, you know, first to third grade, we sort of think of it as learning to read, and after that, you're reading to learn. If you can take a student with dyslexia or who's struggling to learn to read in early kindergarten, give them the skills that they need to be able to read better, they're not going to have the same sort of gaps and struggles that children who aren't picked up until third or fourth grade experience.
Are there any misconceptions that you hear often when it comes to dyslexia that you like to dispel?
I think there are a couple. You know, you already talked about the letter reversals. A lot of people think that it's a visual issue, where we know through research that it's not a visual problem, so vision therapy tends not to be an effective intervention. What students with dyslexia need is what we call structured literacy. So a lot of the literacy and the way literacy is taught in a lot of schools, not just in Maine but across the country, tend to use methods that we don't think are effective for any student, but are especially not effective for students with dyslexia. So if you have a young student and they are in school in sort of a classroom learning how to read, and there's a picture that goes along with the text, a lot of teachers have been trained to say, well, look at the picture and sort of guess what's happening in the picture, and that will help you then get to the words. And, you know, our research indicates that that's not an effective way to teach anyone to read, but for students who don't have the impediments that a student with dyslexia has, they can make sense of it more effectively. For students with dyslexia, that's probably the worst way to teach them to read because, you know, as one of your panelists said earlier, her son, you know, had a wonderful language and a great imagination, so they can just take the picture and run with it. But they're not looking at the words to decode and understand the story. They're just making up their own based on the picture. So we know that there are much more effective ways to teach reading, and we know that they're especially effective for students with dyslexia.
You have children of your own with dyslexia?
Four of my children are dyslexic. There are six of them all together, but four are dyslexic.
What advice would you give to parents of young children, having experience, based on your experience? Is there anything that you would advise them to do?
I think trust your gut. I think if you have a preschool student who loves to listen to stories but has a hard time rhyming words, has a hard time figuring out what a word starts with, those pre-literacy, sort of early literacy sorts of skills. You were talking earlier about how dyslexia is hard to diagnose. It's actually easy, but we don't always look for these sorts of things in students that age. So I think, you know, the work with your student, expose them to books, read to them a lot, and give them the opportunity to work with language. So, you know, if you have a four or five-year-old who's having a hard time figuring out rhymes, who's having a hard time figuring out what sounds a word starts with, even if you're not introducing printed text, but just orally, those are good indicators that there may be a phonological challenge there. If you ask a little kid to name, you know, as many colors as they can think of, and they're having a hard time doing that rapidly, that rapid automation is another good indicator that a child might be a good candidate for dyslexia. And you were talking about the genetics. You know, a lot of times asking or thinking about, you know, am I dyslexic as a parent? If I'm dyslexic as a parent, chances are there's a 25 to 50% likelihood that one of my children will be dyslexic. My family is, you know, the quirk because neither my husband nor I are dyslexic. Four of our children are. And it's certainly prevalent in both of our families. But just being aware of your family tree and your family history, and then looking at some of those early language skills, it gives a parent a good indicator that there may be a reason to dive down deeper into those areas.
All right, Janet, thank you so much for calling in today. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Janet Tebow is president of the International Dyslexia Association's Massachusetts branch. I want to go back to something that she just mentioned about teaching. And there has been, as I understand, a dispute over reading instruction in the education world for some time. Some people have described it as a war over whether it's important, as she was saying, to teach, you know, phonics, basic teaching kids to sound out letters, or whether it's more important that they get a sense of the story and read whole words and all this. So this is not a new argument,
no.
But Amanda, is it closer to being settled? And if not, what are the implications, do you think, for dyslexic children?
Oh, boy. Whether it's closer to being settled, I don't know. I think that there's always a pendulum swing when we're looking at reading instruction and we look at whole language and phonics, and it kind of comes in and out, right? But I think what we know for most kids, including kids who have dyslexia, is that a combination of those types of reading exposure is what we need. And explicit instruction, that like actually breaking things down, making sure you're instructing in multiple kinds of ways, multi-sensory ways, not just looking at it, but feeling it and moving the letters around and sort of using all of your different senses is really important. I think that there are places across the nation that are still struggling with what we have heard of as the reading wars. But I think what we're seeing is in teacher prep programs across the nation, there's more looking at how you teach literacy, how literacy is taught. I know that when I went through college, I didn't learn as much as I would have liked to. I learned a lot in the classroom when I was teaching.
Yeah. Let's go to the phone. So let's bring in Michelle, who's calling from Georgetown. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy the conversation, and I think it's very, very important. And the words that have been used, I think, as a theme today is very important awareness. And what I have found, I have two children with dyslexia. One is severely dyslexic, and my son has been able to come up with internal strategies, but also be able to have an IEP and get his modifications. What I have found about having students, my own students with LD, is systems that aren't in place that don't work for them. And you're sort of touching on it right now, the educational system. And it makes me think of the fact that learning disabilities are invisible. I had one principal in my son's elementary school look at a special educator and say, you know, he just looks so normal. I didn't believe that he could have a reading disability. And I gently said, well, that's a bit discriminatory. And I think those pieces are really important. when I think of people who have a physical disability, whether somebody in a wheelchair in a school system, there is always a ramp for that student to get in the building and be able to access classrooms. And what I have found as a parent advocate student is to use that metaphor to say, where is my daughter's ramp? Where, how can she access this instruction if it's not multisensory, when we know she has severe dyslexia? And along the way, I've been able to find resources to help in my advocacy to get my daughter where she needs to be and my son. But I think it is really important that the educational system as a whole system does not work for the whole community.
Yeah, Michelle, thank you very much.
And
appreciate very much. But I do want to get to this because here we have Michelle, who's an advocate and very involved and may or may, I don't know about her means, but my point is that there are families, for whatever reason, that either don't have the capacity to be as much of an advocate as they can or necessarily the resources to pay for services that they might need. Right, Sandy? Is this
right? Right. And I think as much as possible, parents need to be educated about dyslexia, if that's the learning disability or whatever the learning disability is. Find out as much as you can. There's so much information on the web now. The Learning Disabilities Association of America has a wonderful website with resources for parents. Understood.org has wonderful resources. There's Rights Law, W-R-I-G-H-T Law, that has an incredible amount of legal information for parents. I think a parent needs to be educated. You need to be assertive. You need to be active as much as possible. You need to document your communications with school, and you need to be persistent. And as much as possible, you just need to carry through with that work.
And I think also to rely on people like Sandy and Michelle who are doing this work. Because if you have a parent who is also dyslexic, that research may be very difficult for them. Understood.org, and of course I work for them, so I have like a different knowledge of this. We present information in multiple ways for parents.
I was going to ask you, talk to us about your site.
Sure. So Understood.org was founded by 14 nonprofits in this field coming together, and it's a free resource for parents of kids with learning intention issues, things like dyslexia and ADHD. And we're presenting information to help parents from everything from, I think my child might have dyslexia, what do I do now? To, I'm going into an IEP meeting and I need to advocate, what kind of things can I do?
An IEP is a plan.
Individualized education program plan. I'm glad you stopped me on that one. It's a program that's put in place for kids who need special education services. And the whole point of Understood.org is to provide those resources so parents can then do what they need to do and make the decisions that are best for their family.
1-800-399-3566 to join the program. Let's go to Lynn in Sanford. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Good afternoon. I am very proficient in grammar and algebra, but I'm wondering, is there such a thing as mathematical dyslexia? And Scrabble is a good game.
We touched on this before, but
go ahead. Yeah, I think oftentimes you'll hear that sort of shorthand of math dyslexia, and that is that dyscalculia that we talk about, which is that math disorder. I don't like to use the word disorder necessarily, but it's a specific learning disability within the realm of math, and it does not have to co-occur with dyslexia.
And it also has a number of subtypes, so math disabilities can be categorized in any number of ways. And Lynn, you mentioned you're good at algebra. So that's a really interesting one because there's a very visual side of math and a very sequential detail side of math. And you can be excellent in one part of it and have real difficulties in the other.
So you might be able to solve a problem, but not memorize the multiplication tables, for example.
Absolutely. The memory piece is one area. One of my favorite questions to ask people who come in for math testing is, what did you like better, algebra or geometry? Most of them have an instant answer, and that gives us a lot of information of where we need to look further to identify their particular math issue.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more on the subject of dyslexia. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And the World Affairs Council of Maine, engaging and educating people of all ages to become global citizens. Learn more at wacmaine.org.
On Election Day in November, what will voters be thinking about?
They're thinking about the economy, they're thinking about education, they're thinking about health care.
But what about our environment? On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll explore how gubernatorial candidates from around the region are thinking about climate change and the switch to clean energy. Plus, researchers take on a new public health challenge.
The most frequent cause of death in the lobster fishing community is falls overboard.
Saving lives at sea. Please join us.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
In 1990, then-President George H.W. Bush told the world about a lifelong enemy.
I do not like broccoli, and I haven't liked it since I was a little kid.
How our tastes in food, our preferences in music, even our pets, can reveal our politics.
And I'm president of the United States, and I'm not going to eat any more broccoli.
That's this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Join us this Sunday morning at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, dyslexia and what to do about it. My guests are Sandy Court with Learning Disabilities of Maine, Barbara Melnick of Ocosisco School, and Amanda Morin with Understood.org. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. Before we go any further, there is an event at USM on Monday. Who wants to tell me about it? We'll ask Barbara.
Sure. So this is open to the public. Children 8 and above are welcome. We are going to have Janet Thibault is speaking. We're going to have a panel of students right up through adults who have been through this, who have diagnoses of dyslexia, who are going to talk about their stories. We're going to do some simulation activities, which are really interesting, which although they're not an exact, you know, not going to give you dyslexia for the evening, they will illustrate sort of the kinds of difficulties and how effortful it is for people with these kinds of learning issues to read, and light refreshments. And we'd love to have you there, 5:30 at the Glickman Library.
All right. Very good.
Thank you.
I wanted to get to this idea that for some people with dyslexia may develop certain skills or have developed certain traits about themselves by compensating for other reasons, artistic ability, for example. Does that happen, Amanda?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. You see so many entrepreneurs and celebrities and artists and musicians who will tell you they have dyslexia, and they gravitated towards the things that they were really, really good at. I think, for example, of Richard Branson, who tells this amazing story of not being able to understand the difference between net and gross until one of his employees drew him a net and showed him how the money was coming through the net. I think it's a great. And he has dyslexia. There are many people. There's a designer for Nike who designs all of their shoes. He said that learning how to draw things and take things apart was how he made sense of the world because he has dyslexia.
In addition to Branson, I have a list here. I can't vet it, but Winston Churchill, Albert Einstein, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Muhammad Ali, Steven Spielberg.
Steven Spielberg, we can speak to. He definitely has dyslexia. And Henry Ford, we think.
All right.
And I think it's vitally important, too, for parents to not only focus on the dyslexia and the disability, but focus on the strengths and the interests and feed those. Big time, so that self-esteem is built in and those strengths are accentuated.
Let's go to Hope in Portland. Hi, Hope.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for my call. So I'm an artist. I'm completely dyslexic, but totally never got diagnosed. And today I still struggle. So the biggest thing for me as an artist is to apply for grants and shows. And when it comes to writing, it stresses me out more than anything in the world. Like, I can take apart a house, but I can't actually formulate a simple email or address. And I just wish there was still some help for me. And, like, I actually pay someone to help me. Mm-hmm. because I can't do it. And I remember being in high school and drawing shapes around words because the words weren't active enough for me. And I would have to, like, stamp my foot to create a rhythm for when I was reading just so that I could try to comprehend it, even though I still had a really hard time.
And you're describing your own multisensory techniques. Mm-hmm. You created them on your own, Hope. That's really interesting. And I appreciate the concerns that you're describing as an adult. I don't want to downplay that.
What can adults who discover they are dyslexic or know they're dyslexic and have been for some time, where can they turn to?
I definitely would suggest that they start with LDA, Learning Disabilities Association, right here in Maine, which is Sandy's purview.
Right, right. And I think, too, if they've not been evaluated, see if they can get a good evaluation. If finances are a problem with that, I would contact the Maine Department of Labor, Voc Rehab Services. There are multiple offices throughout the state. That would be a first call. If there's a possibility to financially afford a private evaluation, go that route. But definitely get that information, because that information will give an idea of where your strengths and weaknesses are and how you learn, and where you can plug into perhaps some learning programs. And literacy volunteers for someone that is really, really struggling is a good possibility also. So
good. Let's go to Hope. I'm sorry, we just had Hope. Let's go to Amy in Portland. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me. So I'm an adult with dyslexia. I actually teach at a university and in the communications new media field. My daughter definitely has a processing issue, slightly different from my dyslexia. I think the biggest frustration for me as a parent, and also me growing up, my parents had to fly me down to Chevy Chase, Maryland for the learning and research development of dyslexia back in the 80s to get me fully diagnosed, even though I was in advanced placement in English. Reading is arduous for me, and don't ask me to spell that. and my daughter has more of an auditory processing issue where she comes out more jumbled and definitely has problems with more nonsensical words. But we're both so able to comprehend high enough that we've learned how to compensate, and the school systems, we don't fall below the line. And we still have those very same frustrations. Yet we don't qualify for IEPs because we've learned either one, how to compensate, or two, that gap that we have, that processing gap, just falls below that line. And I think that's one of the hardest things, is there's so many varying degrees of this. Mm-hmm. For people to understand, there's still that frustration because you don't feel like you're unintelligent, but you know that this is not working the way that most academia wants you to learn. Yeah. And you need a different modality to learn.
Yeah. Thanks so much. This can be a problem where if you're performing well, you want to get an IEP and you want accommodations, but unless you're struggling academically, like if you're finding your way around this, it makes it much harder to convince the school that you need the services.
So I think it makes it harder, but it doesn't make it impossible. And there are other ways to access accommodations that, so there's a difference between an IEP, which is a special education program, and what's called a 504 plan, which puts accommodations in place when you don't need specialized instruction. That sounds like a lot of jargon, right? But the bottom line is that a 504 plan can put accommodations in place for a student who has a disability who needs to sort of level the playing field in the general education but doesn't need specialized instruction. It's not a perfect solution, but it's another way of going at it.
And sometimes under the – when a student through the IEP process has achieved a certain level and no longer needs the direct services, a 504 plan will follow them with the accommodations and recommendations. And that 504 can follow them to post-secondary education.
Right, and into the work world,
yeah,
where they may continue to need accommodations.
Oh, well, let's keep it there then. So
sure.
So workplace employers can have an obligation or to do that, or is it something that they do for the benefit of their employees.
Absolutely. This is part of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I just recently heard from a former student of ours who has a wonderful job, but it involves a lot of testing, and the testing happens to be timed. And really, at this point, that's all he needed. But he needed documentation in order to prove that he needed that extended time.
And
but
I think
that's fairly easy.
Yeah, and it's important to note that it's not something an employer will ask. So if it's something you need help with, you need to be able to disclose that information. Right. And not all people are comfortable disclosing that. I know people who have worked through, felt like they've gotten to a point where they're solid in their jobs, and then they start disclosing.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Peter in South Portland. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you? I wish dyslexia were easier to spell. Just kidding. My daughter, we picked it up very early, probably in about third grade, and we realized she was going to have a hard time learning to spell and things like that. So we encouraged her to type. We threatened her, tricked her, bribed her, coerced her, whatever we could do to get her to learn to type. She was in learning disabled classes all the way up through her 10th grade in high school, and but she could type about 120 words a minute. Okay. When she left for the Naval Academy in 1998, we bought her a knee-top computer so she could take notes in class, and she graduated with an engineering degree and a 3.65 grade average. Mm-hmm. She still can't spell, but she can type unbelievably fast. And then the computer, it's not a mistake until somebody reads it and says, hey, that's a mistake.
Spell check has been a wonderful invention,
absolutely,
I think, to some degree, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. And I was just going to follow up with Peter. Did the Naval Academy, were they responsive to her needs, or did she not need any special accommodation?
Hell no, they weren't responsive. She had to be able to compete with all those people who weren't dyslexic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And her power was that she could take notes, not copy what the professor said. She could take notes in class and play Tetris on the side. but it was the fact that she was confident that she could put out a piece of paper that people could read and say, yes, that's what I wanted to see. I mean, by the way, just one other thing. She became quite good at taking notes, and she said, hey, Dad, you realize that the person that takes notes wins the meeting?
All right, Peter, thank you for sharing your story. Appreciate it. We've only got about a minute left, so I wanted to give you a final word. Barbara, any final advice, I guess, for anyone listening who's impacted by this?
Sure. I think early intervention works better than anything else. So if you're seeing signs early on, that's the time to get some help. It's going to make it easiest to, we know that students who are not reading at grade level, by the time they're in fifth grade, the chances that they're going to go way down. So prior to fifth is really when you want to intervene. There's a lot of evidence that intensity is more important than anything else. And so getting that instruction, not just an hour a week, but maybe spending a whole summer working really hard when other school things aren't interfering. And keep, you know, become the advocate and be willing to put up a fight if you need to.
Yeah. Amanda, 20 seconds.
I think as you've heard here today, you're not alone. Just know that you are not alone and there are other people out here doing this.
Yeah. Right.
And I would say take your child and work with the weaknesses, and but also work on those strengths because it's so important.
Barbara, Amanda, Sandy, thank you all for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Barbara Melnick is head of school at Akosisko School. Amanda Morin is a parent advocate, former teacher, and author with Understood.org. And Sandy Court is an original member of the group Learning Disabilities of Maine. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 7 o'clock. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.